Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, Bat-Faced Girl, Human Trampoline, Princess Leia brushing the hair from her forehead, and Fat Charlie the Archangel.
Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I am following the river down the highway through the cradle of the Civil War. I'm going to Graceland, Graceland.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
Okay, so guys, tonight we're going to be talking about Paul Simon's seventh studio album, Graceland. And it's got a pretty interesting story behind it that we'll get into. But before we do that, I'd like to have us all introduce ourselves. So we've got JM Jonathan Rowe, our humble producer.
Hello, everyone.
We've got our host, Mr. Doug Cooper.
Nice to be back. And ladies and gentlemen, I have some exciting news. And this is going to be particularly exciting for the young people out there. You may be a millennial or Generation Z. I just learned about that today. We have an Instagram account. That's right. Instagram. Three old guys are now on Instagram. But don't panic. It's not for our pictures. It's for this podcast. And Tony, what is our Instagram?
Tapping.vinyl.
On Instagram.
Yes.
And we're also on Facebook. Twitter. And we're also on Facebook, where old people belong.
Yes.
And don't forget, you can email us at tappingvinyl@gmail.com. The old fashioned way, going back 30 years. I think I sent my first email 30 years ago.
We sure would like to hear from you guys. You know, we'd love a review, good or bad. Leave us
especially
something.
If you agree with me.
It's good or bad, but yeah, leave something, because we'd like to hear from you guys. List any albums you want to leave a review. It really helps us make things better.
We'd love to hear from Cliche France.
Yes.
Cliche,
our most loyal listener. Okay, boys, well, let's talk a little bit about the history of who this is. So the journey begins in the late 50s when two Jewish teenagers from Queens named Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel began singing professionally as Tom and Jerry. Of course, that name was given to them because their manager at the time thought that Simon and Garfunkel sounded too Jewish. So Tom and Jerry, anyway.
I guess you couldn't find a more Jewish couple of names.
So they had a hit single, their first and only hit single, called Hey Schoolgirl, which was released in
1957.
They actually brought them some national exposure, but in essence, they were a one-hit wonder. After changing their names back to Simon and Garfunkel, it would be almost a decade before they really hit it big. And their first album under their real names was released in 1964, which is called Wednesday 3 AM. And that album was initially not very successful, but it was re-released in 1966 because of the success of The Sound of Silence, which had been remixed, or they added electronic, guitars and stuff to it. So it became a hit. And so they re-released Wednesday 3 a.m. and it ended up charting.
My brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams, I walked alone.
They then called it quits in 1970 after producing what was essentially their biggest hit single from an album of the same name, Bridge Over Troubled Water, which oddly enough was sung completely by Art Garfunkel. I don't believe there's any harmony in that song.
When tears are in your eyes, I will dry them
all. And then after they broke up, Paul Simon went on a solo career. He recorded 6 albums prior to Graceland, including a number one album, Still Crazy After All These Years. And of course, he had several hits with that.
Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy.
All right, well, Tony, thanks for that introduction. And I'm really excited about this album. I love this album. But as y'all know, we don't always agree. So I'm looking forward to that tonight. But before we begin, I've got a special surprise for my two co-hosts.
Uh-oh.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's time to play Make the Connection. I'm going to ask several questions, and I'm going to try to get my other two hosts to connect this to the artist or the album that we've already talked about here on This Is Vinyl Tap. So for our first one, I'm going to do something that's a little bit obvious, I think, but we'll see if they get it. How is this album or this artist connected to REM?
They both had albums that were released in 1986.
I didn't put that together. The actual answer is they both were on Bandstand with Dick Clark. Ah. So now that you know a little bit about how this works, we'll go to the next one. How is this album related to Odyssey and Oracle by the Zombies? Ding!
I have no idea.
Abbey Road Studios.
Really? It was recorded at Abbey Road Studios?
Really?
Part of it, yeah. The Blackman Zabo.
The track Homeless was recorded at Abbey Road Studio.
I thought you were going to say they both had Ladysmith Blackman Mambazo on it.
That would be a surprise to the Zombies.
They wound up being on the floor, yeah.
Now, here is the one I think is the most interesting of all. What does this album have in common with making movies?
They both have extremely boring album covers.
I wouldn't go that far. I think
I don't judge things. So ding, time's up. National Guitar.
Ah.
Oh, yes.
As you all know, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Knopfler plays a National Guitar on what song, JM?
Romeo and Juliet.
And what does that song do to one?
That makes one go into the land of the blues. I don't know. What is it? What does it do?
Boo-hoo.
Damn.
Makes one boo-hoo. Yes, makes one boo-hoo. Okay.
Okay. Now, finally, the last one is probably the most obvious, and we're only going to be able to name a few of them because there's a gazillion of them. Bob Dylan and the album Freewheeling.
They both have guitars on them.
That's right, Tony. You got it. Bob Dylan and Paul Simon are the same age. Bob Dylan and Paul Simon both used to play in the Village. In fact, one time Bob Dylan went to see Paul Simon in the Village and started cracking up during the middle of a show and made Paul Simon very angry. Bob Dylan and Paul Simon both had the same producer, Tony Wilson. And that's in the beginning when he was Simon and Garfunkel. And Paul Simon credits Freewheeling for turning his head around when it comes to music, and got him very serious about the folk deal and particularly about songwriting. So those are just a few, but there's one great Bob Dylan story that we have to tell. Years later, late in Paul Simon's career, he and Bob Dylan toured together. And
I saw that tour. Yes.
One night, they sang The Boxer together.
I'm just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
And when it was complete, Bob Dylan leaned over and asked Paul Simon, on a scale from 1 to 10, how do I compare with Art Garfunkel? So
they're both Jewish, right?
Bob Dylan?
Yeah, they're both Jewish.
Bob Dylan and Art Garfunkel?
Oh, yeah. Everybody is tonight.
So before we continue, Doug, when I pointed at you, you were supposed to get into your whole thing about One Trick Pony, not the game show.
Okay, my bad.
I need to follow it up with how we got to get to Graceland. I didn't just want to end with Still Crazy After All These Years.
That's right. So Paul Simon was incredibly successful in Simon and Garfunkel. One thing about Paul Simon, it's very rare. His father was a bass player. And even though he played bass, he was still a good musician. And Paul Simon, when he signed his contract, unlike everybody else we talked about, he kept all of the publishing. So that has made him one of the wealthiest performers out there. Incredibly successful with Simon and Garfunkel. And then on his own, he puts out three albums that were nominated for Grammys. He was just at the top of his game. Great reviews, and he has great sales. But he gets tired at Columbia, and he moves to Warner Brothers. When he gets to Warner Brothers, he's working on a project. It's a movie. He decided he needed to make a movie. And he also decided he didn't need very much help from people who make movies. And he decided he needed to star in the film. And he put out a film called One Trick Pony. Everybody's going, well, I didn't know he was in a movie. Well, that's right. And that's part of the problem, because it was an expensive movie that cost Warner Brothers a bunch of money. And then it flopped.
I remember trying to watch it with my dad and when it came out and just going, This was one of the, I didn't know a bad movie from a good movie back then, but even then I was going, yeah, that like Bad News Bears, Go to Japan, and then One Trick Pony were like the two, not all movies are good.
Well, and everybody in America agreed with you, and that was a big, big loser. Then his next album, Hearts and Bones, which is a critically appreciated album, sold fewer albums than he had ever sold before and didn't have a hit. So Warner Brothers is thinking that they've made a disastrous deal. And Paul Simon is at the bottom of his career. He's also just had a second divorce.
You can't dismiss the fact that he and Garfunkel got back together and had in the early part of that sort of downward spiral, had a very, an amazing moment where they played live in Central Park in 1981. Yeah.
April, come she will. Streams are ripe.
Yeah, but even that was contentious. They said that.
Leading up to it. But what I read was Paul Simon said when they got out on stage, the rain stopped, the clouds opened up, and it was just this amazing, magical moment. Enough for them to go on tour afterwards. They actually toured together, and that led to Hearts and Bones was actually going to be a reunion album.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, Garfunkel recorded some vocals on it. Evidently, according to Paul Simon, he lost interest. So Paul Simon stripped his vocals off of it and released it as a solo album.
Well, Paul Simon realized that the album he was creating was way too personal to be a collaboration. Yeah. And if you listen to the album, you can understand it's Hearts and Bones is about Carrie Fisher and Paul Simon's relationship.
On the last leg of a journey they started a long time ago.
Right, his second wife, who he was married to for not very long, but as we talked about before the podcast, they dated off and on. But yeah, so Hearts of Bones comes out in 83. Paul Simon is just, I mean, he's had this really unpleasant experience touring with Garfunkel. He's divorced Carrie Fisher. He's heartbroken. He puts out this album that, as you said, is a critical success, but nobody seems to want to listen to it.
And he's here's another thing that's really important to this story is music is changing quickly and Paul Simon is getting left behind. It's the time of Michael Jackson, Prince, and Madonna, and it's the time of MTV, and nobody cares about the old guy that their parents used to listen to that's coming out. And it's something interesting about this is MTV is destroying him. And as we'll find out when we get into this, MTV rescues him a little later. And it's a great story. This is a story of redemption. It's interesting. The album itself redeemed Paul Simon's career. And the album itself, particularly the lead track, is about redemption.
Right.
And that's the theme of this album story that we're telling tonight.
Yeah. Yep. I was one of those people. I remember just thinking that, I remember my parents got, you got that joined Columbia House Records and you get the cassettes for a penny or whatever. And I remember my dad going, let me go ahead and get crazy after all these years. I've got that on vinyl, but I don't have it on cassette. So I remember just going on family trips going, oh my God, we got to listen to this dinosaur sing this stuff. And because I grew up on Paul, Simon and Garfunkel. One of the earliest memories I have is actually listening to Bridge Over Troubled Waters. But and I was at that age. I was at the age where Prince was, I wasn't the biggest Prince fan, I'll be honest with you. I was much more in the REM camp and the Springsteen camp and all that. But I looked at this as dinosaur rock and I had absolutely no interest whatsoever in anything that Paul Simon was doing.
I didn't even think of him as rock and roll.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's hard he gets lumped into that oldies things. And he, we were talking about this earlier. He's from Queens. He's from New York. He writes songs about New York and everything, but there's just nothing gritty about him. Like Lou Reed or, any of those bands that were playing. Well,
the same people that listened to the Carpenters like Simon and Garfunkel.
Exactly.
And he had a hard time overcoming that in the Newport, concert. He got left behind. He stuck out. Simon and Garfunkel stuck out. They got Jimi Hendrix lighting guitars on fire. You got Janis Joplin. And here comes, I am just a poor boy. And it just didn't work.
Can I say something, though, about all that? That might have been the case then in that package touring stuff. But I think almost more than any other music that came out at that era, I think Simon and Garfunkel stuff is timeless. I don't think sounds dated. I don't think it sounds of the time. Mm. I mean, that's not the same. And I know you guys feel differently about this album. That's not the same way I feel about Graceland. I think Graceland feels like a relic of the mid 80s to me.
See, I think the exact opposite. When I listen to Paul Simon I listen to Simon and Garfunkel, to me, it does sound like that early 70s BJ Thomas sort of production, Bread kind of production.
You sheltered me from harm, kept me warm.
It sounds very stuck in the 70s. Now, I think that doesn't mean I think there's bad songs on it, that the songs are bad, but I just don't think they're timeless. I listen to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. To me, that stuff sounds like a lot more timeless than that.
Right now, our audience is wondering how I get both of y'all to disagree with each other and wrong at the same time.
Well, and here's the funny thing when you talk about him feeling left behind. I mean, he did kind of do what artists did in the late 70s, and he, and, you know, semi-embraced that horrible stuff we call disco. I mean, even though 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover isn't quite a disco song, it's close enough for Paul Simon. Oh,
Late in the Evening from One Trick Pony sounds totally disco.
First thing I remember, I was lying in my bed. Couldn't have been no more than one or two. And I remember there's a radio coming from the room next door. My mother laughed.
So anyway, we get come to Graceland. So
yeah, Paul, we'll as you said, Instagram, as you said, and everybody can tell y'all how wrong y'all are. And, right, as kids?
As you said, Doug, this is an album about, this is a redemption story. And for that reason, I really appreciate the story behind this album, even if I'm not, and I want to be on the record here, I do not dislike this album. I'm not crazy about it either after all these years, but I unlike some people who shall remain nameless, I'm not going to sit here and grumble the whole time about the album, because there are some things about it I like.
Well, I think the person that you're not naming doesn't grumble. He just takes little pot shots.
But I got you. Fair enough. But anyway, so yeah, this album has a very interesting story, and part of the history of it is Paul Simon being villainized by a group of people, and I think all three of us agree unfairly so.
The history of this goes back to, you know, Paul Simon, as we were saying earlier, he was depressed, going through a pretty hard time. I believe it was Lorne Michaels said, you should, who was actually Paul Simon's next door neighbor and very good friend. Lorne Michaels is the executive producer and founder of Saturday Night Live. He's been with it most of the time that it's been in existence. Yeah, 40 years of its existence. Yeah. And so he said, there's this artist that you should check out and you should consider producing her. So anyway, he was producing said artist.
Are you talking about Heidi Berg, who was in the she was in the house band for Saturday Night?
That's right. She was in the house band for Saturday Night Live. That's the Lorne Michaels connection. That's correct. She was making a solo album, and she said that she wanted it to sound like these two bands that were on a cassette that she lent to Paul Simon. And Paul Simon was driving to and from the studio while he was working in the studio with her, producing her album. And he just fell in love with it. And he just said, I got to, you know, find out who this band is. So since he was working with Warner, he was on a contract with Warner Brothers. He's got some people to find out who those two bands were. And he traced them down to South Africa. And as the story goes, he had, since he was kind of, you know, on the outs with Warner Brothers, he kind of felt like that gave him carte blanche to kind of just do what he wanted. And so he and his longtime engineer, can't remember his name.
Roy Halley.
Thank you. He's
more than an engineer by this.
Yeah. Point. He's much more than an engineer. But, so they went down to, they booked a flight, went to South Africa.
Well, hold on. I want to tell just a quick little part on that. Okay. Earlier in his Simon and Garfunkel years, he did a song called El Condor Pasa. And he did that. He took the recording from the Andean band that did it, and then he put his lyrics to it, and he combined the song with what he had. And that's what he had in mind initially in doing with this South African music.
Yeah.
But just as JM said, he was off the radar at Warner Brothers, so he was able to just scoot on down there.
So they went down there, they booked a couple of weeks in a studio there, and they just started recording jam sessions. And
it sounds like a crazy time. I mean, I think the wives were coming in, they were bringing the kids in. It was just like a big it was a big party.
Big family and, gathering. Yeah.
And I had heard or read that because of apartheid, the musicians started to get worried as the sun went down. Because
they were scared of how they were going to get home.
How are they going to get home? So they wouldn't relax as it got closer to the end of the day. They wouldn't relax until they knew there was a car that was going to take them home. Because otherwise, there was going to be some problems. Yeah.
And they also got paid, I think, five times the golden rate.
Three times. Yeah.
They got paid three times. No, they got paid
New York.
Something like.
Yeah.
Three times the going rate in New York.
It was $15 an hour there, and they were making at least $200 an hour.
Yeah.
And, Dan, do you get paid that when you play the bass? you get a couple of free beers.
I get a couple of free beers and, a bag of chips. Anyway, so that's how they just booked some time in a studio. They started recording, they started jamming, and Paul Simon took those tapes back to New York, where he was living at the time, and just started kind of listening to them and writing lyrics to the jams that they were having. So if you listen to Roy Halley, what he says was, there was absolutely no way they could have made this album had it not been for digital recording, because they wound up just moving all those jams around. They wound up taking drum tracks from some songs and putting them on top of other ones. A lot of the stuff is still just the rhythm parts are still intact. They just put some, what Paul Simon said, they just put some echo on the backing tracks and occasionally filled them out. So,
well, I don't know how much we want to get into the politics of this, but hopping a plane to South Africa wasn't the easiest thing for him to do. No. The story goes, he reached out. He had a good friend, a couple of good friends he talked to before he went, Harry Belafonte and Quincy Jones.
And he talked to him where?
During the We Are the World session.
It's a choice we're making.
Anyway, and I think Harry Belafonte told him that he needed to talk to the African National, is it Council?
Congress. Yeah. African National Congress.
I don't think he did. I don't think Paul Simon did.
He did it.
Before he went, even though Harry Belafonte told him he should. And so he went over there and... There was a lot of criticism thrown at him when he and Halley landed, despite the fact that they weren't actually, performing there. They were utilizing musicians who didn't have a whole lot of widespread, fame outside of South Africa, but outside of the black community in South Africa. So, he gets tagged with this criticism about that.
Let's keep in mind that we have three listeners that aren't in their 50s or older, and we may need to provide some context. I was in college, JM probably was too, but at the University of Texas, they had a shanty town built that was part of the protest against South Africa. And they were saying the University of Texas needed to disinvest from South Africa, and everybody was upset about apartheid, which was just a hideous system of separation in South Africa, and the whole world was against it. And someone that JM and I both love to death, as far as his music goes, Little Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band, also from Sopranos,
Silvio
and the Sopranos. Also, the writer and producer of the greatest band in the world, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, and also a creator of some fantastic music himself. He led the Sun City effort. Sun City was a very fancy, a whites-only resort that he started a... He came up with a song called Sun City. It was a big hit. Everybody sang on it. And the whole thing was, I'm not going to play at Sun City. And they were boycotting, musicians were boycotting all of South Africa, particularly Sun City. I would like to know the guys that were in charge of booking at Sun City when this guy, Steve Van Zandt, says he's not going to play there. They go, who the hell's that? But little Steven still has not forgiven Paul Simon for doing that. And one of his quotes cracked me up. He said, who is Paul Simon to think he knows better than the voters who elected the leaders of South Africa? Which is funny, as anytime the voters in this country have elected a president, that little Steven did it, like he's had plenty to say about it.
Well, here's a couple of interesting things about that kind of attitude. Number one, Paul Simon says that the musicians in South Africa voted.
Yeah, the musicians union voted black.
Voted to let him come. They voted to let him come. And what's also interesting was he was blacklisted until 1987 for doing this. It was finally removed from the South African blacklist, if that's what it was called, in 87. But he was blacklisted for doing this.
The hell he caught on this side of the Atlantic was much worse than the hell he caught on the other side with the black musicians that he actually employed. And
they were excited as could be to have the opportunity.
And the whole thing that he said was, if you listen to, there's a documentary made about making this album. He said that the idea wasn't to make any sort of political statement. He said, that's just not who I am. I don't make political statements. I heard a very good band that was inspiring me. I wanted to go down. So I look at it as getting away from the politics of it. I didn't want to make a political album. I didn't want to make a political statement. I just wanted to sell this. If anything, I wanted to celebrate this culture that was in South Africa that was being sort of overlooked, that was being neglected. He said, if you go down to that part of South Africa where all of that poverty was and everything was going on, it was music in the streets all over the place.
That's a fascinating thing about this album. It's a political album. I mean, it's steeped in politics because of its history, but it's not a political album. And by its very existence, it's kind of a social commentary without having any social commentary on the album. I mean, it's very, very unique in that way.
Well, and, you know, in his defense, it should be said, this was a boycott on performing in South Africa for white audiences.
Yeah.
This was not a boycott against using South musicians Africans. Using South African musicians who were the victims.
The other side, and you know, this takes some sensitivity to talk about. But the other side was, once this was all done and the album was in the can and it was getting accolades from some people and he was performing with these musicians, then the other thing came out, which was the accusation that he was, you know, appropriating this music from the people who really made it all of that other stuff. And I find that there's a distinction between people who truly do that and someone like Paul Simon, who goes on Saturday Night Live with this band backing him and knocks the pants off of everybody watching that performance, you know? And they weren't knocked out because of Paul Simon.
No.
Yeah.
No. The whole idea of cultural appropriation with music really bothers me, because all music is that it all is, all of rock and roll is appropriation of a bunch of different groups of music. And but it's good to remember that the self-righteous virtue signaling didn't just start this decade, kids. It's been around. Your parents did it.
Well, anyway, so that's kind of the environment in which this album was created. And it's incredible to think that it ever I don't know, this is maybe throwing too much weight on kind of the way things happen now. I don't know if an album like this can be made today.
I think that's a very legitimate question.
I think that's a very legitimate question. Yeah.
I don't know. Because I think that it would get so much heat, and that's the problem. That's the problem is that this is not, as the more you dive into this and the situation behind it, the more you realize, look, let's face it. Paul Simon wasn't necessarily being altruistic. I mean, he wanted to make a product using these musicians. So he did have a self-interest, which is fine, but he also, it was a benefit to these musicians. And he wanted, I genuinely believe him when he said he wanted to get people to know who these people were, because he fell in love with this music to when he first started looking for it. He thought it was some obscure doo-wop band that he didn't know about, and he loved that doo-wop music. So I do believe him.
There are people, then they hear music, they want to tell other people about it.
Right.
It's just natural. Some people even start podcasts to do that.
Exactly. it would be tough, I think, for him to it would be interesting to see if someone with the amount of heat that he got, and he got a lot of heat, would be able to A, do this, and be as successful as he was with it. Because by all accounts, I don't want to say it was a comeback, but it was an album of redemption. It redeemed his career.
It's such a huge album. People, you say Paul Simon, this is the first thing they say now instead of Bridge Over Troubled Waters.
So let's hit first song on side one, which is The Boy in the Bubble.
The bomb in the baby carriage is wired to the radio. These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to us all. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying.
This is the third single released. It hit number 86 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 15 on the U.S. album Rock Tracks. It was written by, credit is given to Paul Simon and an accordionist named, Forere Motohaleo.
Motohala.
When you hear this song, the first thing that smacks you upside the head is the accordion, because it's so unusual, so rhythmic.
And it's an accordion playing like an accordion never has.
Yeah, it's unlike any accordion you've ever heard.
It's serious accordion music. I've never heard serious accordion before. That's like serious banjo or something.
Yeah. You're not. It's not like Flaco Jimenez is in there. No. Or and the Switz Alps
or
something.
That's from later on the album when you get into that Zydeco's swinging stuff.
Yeah.
Again, as we'll talk about this, we're dealing with two people who adore this album, and one person, me, who's kind of lukewarm about it. But there are points that I love. I did find it interesting that Ballou plays on this song. Adrian Ballou, who is JM. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Adrian Ballou?
Yeah, Adrian Ballou has been around for a while. He started off with Frank Zappa, and then he moved into working with the Talking Heads. That's where he probably got where his name probably pretty much got made. Right. Unusual
played
guy.
Played with Bowie, too.
Yeah, played with Bowie. And King Crimson. So he's got kind of a pedigree. He's kind of famous for making very unusual sounds on his guitar. And if you listen to the guitar solo on this, he's playing something called a guitar synthesizer. It looks like a guitar, but it's instead of it has the electronics of a synthesizer. So when you're hitting the notes, you're actually completing a current on the strings of the guitar. So it makes it sound like you can make it sound like a keyboard. And so when you're hearing that guitar solo on that, that's Adrian Ballou. And he's just famous for being able to just coax just about any sound out of any sort of guitar. And he's coaxing some weird sounds out of this on this song with the that guitar synthesizer. He plays on a couple of other songs on this.
Yeah, he's on a couple of songs. I think this is a good time for me to talk about this interview I read with him where he talks about this album. And so he said that Paul Simon contacted him because he wanted to put a bit of a different edge over all the African music sounding music he was making on Graceland. And so Baloo shows up at the studio and Paul Simon's not there, but Roy Haley is. And Roy Haley starts playing the music tracks from these songs. And Baloo's like, what is this? This doesn't sound, I mean, he liked it, but he thought he put the wrong album on. He's like, well, this doesn't sound anything like Paul Simon. It was just a bunch of South African musicians playing together. He couldn't understand what it was. And so he really thought he'd put the wrong tape on. And then Paul Simon shows up and Baloo says to him, he goes, look, I'm concerned. This doesn't sound like you. What's going on? And so Paul Simon walks, this is a pretty cool story, walks up to Adrian Baloo and starts singing the songs in his ear, the lyrics, and you know, like words to Boy in the Bubble and stuff. And Baloo said he got it. And it just, he just got chills up and down his spine when he's going out. And he's like, okay, I'm in. You got me.
Well, this song, I remember the first time I heard that. My reaction was, I didn't know where to put it. It is something that, I don't know if it still sounds that way to people who hear it for the first time now, but when I heard it, I go, what is this? I don't know what this is. How is this possible? And it made my brain, I can still remember walking around on campus with this in my head, and it was just making strange things happen in my head. It's really a statement to come on at the very beginning of this album saying, hey, folks, you remember that Paul Simon? This is not me with my acoustic guitar playing. You know, if you ripped all the acoustic guitar off this album, I don't think you would notice. It's just so bizarre.
And this, I don't mean this to sound as obvious as it does what I'm about to say.
Like obvious child.
But what's really, I mean, I don't know much about Paul Simon's writing methods. But the thing that strikes me the most about this album, and in particular the ones that have the kind of the African beat to them, is the songs impact his phrasing so much when he's singing.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a reason for that. He used to sit down with a guitar and pick out a melody and then put words to it and let the song develop over months and months. And then bring in other instruments to create the song. He did the exact backwards on this album.
Yeah.
And it to good effect, but it also is going to get him in trouble a couple of times. But he got the whole thing laid out. And then I think it was this song he was talking about where he just listened to it over and over again. And he just starts putting those words out there. And eventually he has a song, but he built the basement first. Yeah. And then built on top of it instead of what he usually does.
Huh. Yeah, there's a video of him where he's actually standing around putting the lyrics together for Graceland, where he's standing in his flat in New York, and he's got speakers all over the place, and he's just walking from room to room writing lyrics to Graceland. Yeah,
whatever comes to him, and it's pretty fascinating because we'll talk about Graceland in a minute, but all of these songs, he kind of finds out what they're about as he reaches the end of composing them.
Well, and the other obvious, well, not so obvious thing here, but something that you comment on a lot, Doug, and I think it applies to this album almost more than any album we've ever talked about, is the music being so upbeat compared to what the subject matter is about.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think the music of Boy in a Bubble is upbeat. I think it has the same seriousness as the basically it's a look at the modern world with a lot of the ugly side of the modern world. And I think that's why that accordion sounds accordion. So
it almost sounds weird. Harsh.
It does. You know? And I've never heard someone do that with an accordion before. But It's like there's a reason all this music is happy, and that's because the people who recorded with play happy music. And when we talk about Graceland, there's a funny story about that.
Yeah, there is. Well,
this was the Graceland is the next song, title track on the album. It was the second single released. It hit number 81 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 38 on the U.S. album rock tracks.
Poor boys and pilgrims, the families. We are going to Graceland.
My traveling companion is 9 years old. He's the child of my first marriage.
And I've got a confession to make. So I know this song as well as almost any song. I've heard it a million times, but I've never listened to it. So when we were preparing for this thing, I put it on when I was running with my wife, not running from her, running with her. And and I
so
listened.
She's out.
Yeah, she's out. And I heard the lyrics for the first time and they just broke my heart. I almost boo-hooed, to quote JM.
Yes.
Guard your turf.
and I can't listen to this song anymore the same way after hearing those lyrics. They're unbelievably heartbreaking lyrics. The bit where he talks about, you know, I'm assuming it's Carrie Fisher, about knowing that, you know, that she's going to leave, you know, even after she tells him, he's like, yeah, it's obvious. Yeah. Oh my God. It just gut punch. But, I don't know. Going back to something that we talked about in the Reckoning podcast about lyrics and how I said, you know, lyrics aren't always that important. They completely changed my outlook of this song. A song I always thought was a nice little song, but I absolutely love it now. But it's hard for me to listen to because I'm caught up in how horrible this guy's, you know, what this guy's going through.
Imagine if you were Paul Simon and you found out what this song was about while you were writing it, because that's what happened.
Yeah, it's a great story. He was writing it on his way to Memphis with his son.
Hold on. You got to back up a little bit.
Yeah.
He had this tune in his head and he was saying, I'm going to Graceland, Graceland, I'm going to Graceland. And he kept saying that over and over again. And he said, okay, I know that's just a place keeper for the tune.
Yeah.
I'll replace that later. It's not about Elvis. I don't know why I keep saying that, but he couldn't get rid of it. So what he says is he decided he better go to Graceland to figure out why.
Well, he had just recorded with Rockin' Dobsey. Is that who's on this album as well? Yeah, and he was driving back from Louisiana. He said, well, as long as I'm here, I might as well go to Memphis.
He eventually puts this song together. I mean, the line, Mississippi Delta shining like a national guitar. That was a bottleneck guitar. Then it was another kind of guitar. And then he landed on national guitar, which is perfect.
It makes perfect sense.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know, National Guitar is a brand and they make a steel guitar that's shiny. And it looks like a Mississippi Delta, for example.
the lyrics are, I mean, if there's any doubt about what a great songwriter Paul Simon is, just pull these lyrics up and look at them. Yep. They're unbelievably emotionally deep and they're incredible.
And Paul Simon takes writing lyrics extremely seriously.
Yeah, he does. So another thing that about this song is it started off as one of those jams in South Africa, but he didn't like anything that they were actually what the tune actually was. But he did love the drums, and he said the thing I liked about the drums is that it sounded like a kind of one of those four on the floor freight train kind of Johnny Cash country songs. And so he started writing the chords to it that were real simple. And then Ray Fiery, the guitar player, just said, well, let me try to write something over the top of that. And he started playing what he thought would be what a country Western guy would play.
This is one of the coolest things on the album. And I was about to make Jackson Brown sing my songs to me, one of the things on my quiz, because that's what it reminded me. Paul Simon says all these African songs are just three chords and they never have the relative.
They never
minor.
Go to a minor.
So and it's he just said that, 1, 4, and 5. And he's playing that. And all of a sudden, this African guitarist who is incredible.
Yeah.
I can't stop watching him. But
he's amazing.
He drops into C minor, C sharp minor.
C sharp minor.
And Paul Simon goes, What did you just do?
Why would you do that?
And he goes, well, I listened to your music and I thought that's what you would do. So
that's
Paul's
hilarious.
All the way across the ocean trying to get this African sound. And here's this African guy trying to sound like Paul Simon. And if you listen to this guy play guitar, it's reminiscent of a little rockabilly licks that he's dropping in there. And I never thought of that before until I was tipped off to it.
And of course, who provides some vocals on this song?
The Everly Brothers. He said that he could have seen the Everly Brothers singing this song, which I guess I could see that as well.
With a different bottom end.
It's funny that you talk about the no minor chords and the way these African musicians approach their music, because one of my beefs about this album, for the most part, one of the things that I find hard for me to get over is a lot of these songs have a sameness to them that I don't find very interesting.
Really? That's the thing to me. I think all these songs sound very different, but yet
the two we've talked about just seem
light so years far apart. Yeah.
And then the style changes, but you got to remember this is after two divorces. And you can tell this is about redemption, and he accidentally wrote this song about redemption, and it fits his life so perfectly. It's just like a miracle the way he comes to it. And then, of course, he and Carrie Fisher were off and on over and over and over again, even after they divorced. And this line, she comes back to tell me she's gone, as if I didn't know my own bed, as if I never noticed the way she brushed her hair from her forehead. Oh, losing love, it's like a window in your heart. Everyone sees you're blown apart. Everyone sees the wind blow.
Oh, yep. Man.
I'd give like $1 million to write that line.
It's just, and to think he's just stumbling into this idea of redemption by accident. And that's who he talks about. He and his boy go to Graceland, and they didn't get prior anything set up. They just get on the bus with all these other people. And that's where Poor Boys and Pilgrims, and we're all going to Graceland. And eventually the name Graceland takes on a new meaning, because that's what he's looking for, a little grace.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really great. Just that little line seems so throwaway, but it's so great about poor boys and pilgrims. That concept, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you just get this idea of all these people, they realize that they're washed up and they failed, and they're looking for a little grace. And that's what they got at Graceland.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Amazing song.
No, it is. It is. All right. We'll move on to number three. I Know What I Know. Okay. You guys are going to have to talk about this, because I dislike this song immensely.
All right, in a sort of a limited way for an off night. She said, don't I know you from the cinematographer's party? I said, who am I to blow against the wind? I know what I know.
It's not my favorite song on the album, but I do not dislike it.
It's not a drum solo.
It's just so monotonous.
The drums, the drums are just bizarre on this.
I remember feeling the way you do, Tony.
Are you going to set me straight then, please?
It just grew on me. And I don't know what to say. It just, you know, it's so funny. This whole album, the lyrics are so first world and the music is so third world.
Yeah.
You got them. Can you imagine all these guys playing? And he goes, I met her at a cinematographer's party.
Yeah.
We don't even say that in Texas. That's a New York deal. That's pure New York. Yeah. And by the way, Paul Simon's the most New York person in rock and roll, in my opinion. It
depends what you call rock and New York, but you know,
he makes me think. I can't think of him being anywhere but New York.
But well, yeah, I mean, then it's got those backup vocals going. Ooh, ooh. Yeah, that's just in the weird ass bass.
Boom.
I just find it so monotonous. I find it so uninteresting and not tuneful at all. This song drones to me.
We'll move on. We'll move on.
No, you guys can talk about it. I mean, I think it's good.
There's not much else. It's one of those songs that was almost totally recorded in South Africa. This was one of the ones that there wasn't a whole lot of that was done to it after they got back to the States.
I will tell you that the tune is not that interesting. And if he didn't have all these players making up fun, I don't think it would have gone anywhere.
Well, yeah. Speaking of not going anywhere, I feel that way about the next song too.
What's a gumboot, Tony?
I have no idea. You tell me.
That's it's like galoshes.
You don't feel you could love me, but I feel. You don't feel you can love me, but I feel you could.
Okay.
That's what those guys wear in the mines there.
I think this song starts off pretty good. You know, it's fun, but then it doesn't, to me, it just doesn't go anywhere after that. Oh,
I think it's fun the whole way through. I love the line, you don't feel you could love me, but I feel you could. That sounds like something I would say. Back in my single days, I would never say that now, darling.
I mean, yeah, how many times have I, you don't think you could love me, but I think you could.
I feel you could.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a fun song.
It's not one of my favorites again, but I still think it's a very fun
song. It's certainly not filler. Neither one of those are filler.
Okay.
I'll tell you how I can tell is this Gumboots. I during my obsession with this album this week, I purposely pulled it up on my phone to hear it one time. So instead of being one that you skip, that's one I sought out.
I sought it out as well to play it to my wife who loves this album and hadn't listened to it for about 20 years to show her a song that just drives me nuts.
Well, the next one, Tony, there's no way.
No, this next song is fantastic. Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes is a fantastic song.
He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket, empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na, ta-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na, she got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
It was the fourth single released. I don't think it charted any significant charts.
I wonder if anybody didn't have the album by then.
Well, you might be. I mean, we talk about that a lot. Awesome. When you release all those singles, at some point people stop buying them, right? But but this was a song they performed on Saturday Night Live that just blew the top of everyone's head off.
And that's this is what made me buy the album. I just remember seeing them. I have never seen anything like this at all.
Well, and it's got probably the most well-known South African band from this album, or the one people know the most, which is Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
Mambazo.
And they're primarily an a cappella band. So for them to get into singing with a bunch of instrumentation was an interesting stretch for them.
It was a big stretch, and it didn't come naturally at first.
If you watch them perform this on Saturday Night Live, it's so much fun. Oh,
it's beautiful. Like,
the choreographed dance moves and the way they're singing behind him, and they're just having a blast.
They do all those dance moves that they just like.
Yeah,
it's moves so that fun. I would find it's very so, difficult
this,
to do.
It is this is so a fun song.
This that band. What they did on no American anywhere could have pulled off what they were doing. And it was so completely natural. If you saw Americans up there doing all that, you'd go, what?
What is that?
But when they're doing it, it goes, y'all have reached the peak of your art. This is amazing.
And the fact that they could do it while they're singing.
Well, anyway, this is this appeared on Saturday Night Live, which is a big deal in Paul Simon's life.
He
had met Carrie Fisher once, but the second time he met her when they started going out was at the Saturday Night Live set. and he met Edie Bakel at the Saturday Night Live sketch. And he's been on the show a bunch of times. He's almost a not ready for primetime
play. Didn't he play in a chicken suit one time?
Yep.
Yeah, for still crazy after all the
on that at Turk. It was Thanksgiving.
Was he was the first one that was the musical guest and the host.
And then one time he got on there the same time as Senator Paul Simon, and they both walked out there and said, "Oh, I thought it was me that was supposed to be on tonight."
So, do you guys know? Can you guys talk about what the song's about?
Poor boy going out with a rich girl.
She makes the sign of a teaspoon. He makes the sign of a wave. The poor boy changes clothes and puts on aftershave to compensate for his ordinary shoes.
Wants to take her dancing, but they can't get in anywhere, so they wind up sleeping on
in a doorway.
And doorways on Broadway.
And I think after he has to put on aftershave to compensate for his ordinary shoes. But I think by the time they have a successful date, he feels like he does have diamonds on the soles of his shoes by the end of the song.
So it's like essentially walking on clouds.
Yeah. Or sunshine.
Yeah. Thanks, Katrina.
But then I love the way that this song ends. It just ends with that a cappella.
Yeah.
It's the most addictive thing in the world.
Yeah.
It's a great song.
You like it the first time you hear it too, which is
it's one of those songs that I think encapsulates what he was trying to do with this stuff. I know you guys feel differently than me. I don't think it succeeds on a lot of it, but this song, it's perfectly successful.
And it was almost not on the album.
Was it them performing it on Saturday Night Live that put it on the album?
Well, I don't remember why it wasn't, but it kind of came late.
I think he had this song written, but he just didn't like it. And then they went to New York to do it.
Is that the one where
they performed it. And I think the reception it got is why he added it to the album.
Yeah.
But he did perform it months before the album came out. I don't know how you could hear that and not think that's not going to be on my next album. Well, I'm going to put it on all the albums I've already done.
How often have we talked about musicians not quite getting, you know, they're like, this isn't a song. Yeah, and then it kind of blows up in a way that they don't expect.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we flip over the album and we get to song one on side two, which is Doug.
You Can Call Me Out.
If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long lost pal. I can call you Betty, Betty, when you call me.
It's a hit.
It's a hit. That's right.
It's a hit.
It's a hit.
This is definitely the first single out of the gate and a big hit. Yeah. It may be Paul Simon says that it's when he's singing this song that he realizes the tour needs to end. I think this is the first one he gets tired of.
Well, what's funny about this song was it when it was released, it hit number 44. And then Graceland won a bunch of Grammys for, you know, songs and albums. And then they re-released it and it charted again and hit number 23.
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is this album really wasn't going anywhere. And we talked about it was all Paul Simon was old news and it was all these video superstars, Prince, Michael Jackson and all that. And then here's Paul Simon. How is he going to put out a video that competes with Thriller or something like that? And he absolutely can't. So they came up with this campy deal that he's going to do. Yeah. And then he goes, well, let me go see Hal. He goes to see his friend, Al Michaels.
And Lauren Michaels.
Lauren Michaels. Who's Al Michaels? Oh, that's because you can call him Al. I'm thinking you're calling him Al.
Yeah, you're going
and they,
to
football. They go to the Saturday Night Well one more time and they pull off, which is one of the only videos that you can still watch that doesn't make you embarrassed that you ever watched it when you were young. It's very fun.
It, It's funny. It's really great. It's goofy. And when they're dancing together, seeing, you know, the short Paul Simon and this very, very tall
6'4" Chevy Chase.
It's really, really great. So you guys know about where the title came from, right?
Yes.
I do not.
Paul Simon's at a party in New York with his wife, and there's a French composer who was, I think he was the chief conductor of the New York Philharmonic at the time. His name's Pierre Boulez.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's attending the same party, and he calls Paul Simon Al and his wife Betty the entire night.
Yeah.
The entire night.
Yeah.
So he's like, okay, I'll write a song about it. I think, didn't the song title track win Grammy for best song?
It was nominated. I don't think it got it. He was getting wiped out on everything. And I just remember reading this, and it was dramatized in my book, because it's one failure. He doesn't get production. He doesn't get male vocalist. He doesn't get single, and he's really upset. And then boom, he gets the album.
Well, maybe that's what I'm thinking of. The album was, I think, the lowest charting album ever to win Album of the Year or something like that.
Until
Robert Plant and Alison Krauss. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it's the album, not the song. Gotcha.
He kept being nominated for Grammys one after another. And then Stevie Wonder would beat him.
Every time.
When he finally got one for Still Crazy After These Years. And he gets up on stage and goes, I'd just like to thank Stevie Wonder for not putting an album out this year.
That's pretty funny. Okay, so now we move on to the second song on side two, Under African Skies.
And he walked his days under African skies. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the vein.
This is the fifth and final single. I don't believe this charted at all. And it features Linda Ronstadt on it, singing with him. And she gets top billing along with him on the single, too.
Well,
and she's so good.
That's a great song.
But, you know, she caught one of the reasons why this album caught hell was because Linda Ronstadt had played Sun City. And they didn't like that she had actually.
And she didn't know about it. And she was on the blacklist. But little Steven said they dropped all of the names that were on that list because a lot of them didn't know about the boycott before they were
going to. I think Paul Simon, what I read, Paul Simon was, they released that album, I'm Not Going to Play Sun City, or the single or whatever it was. Remember that song? And Paul Simon was asked to be on it. And he refused because at the time they were going to name the names. And he's like, yeah, you can't do that. What are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, because he also knew people like Linda Ronstadt were that, you know, they weren't as politically aware as other people. So they didn't know that there was, we've talked about another band that went down to South Africa and it ended up breaking up, the Birds when they did it. You know, Graham Parsons wouldn't go down there with them. So there was a lot of people who didn't quite get what all that was about.
Yeah.
But, Linda Ronstadt is so good looking and she sings so well.
and he even said he wrote part of the lyrics with her in mind.
Well, and then the Joseph in the song is about the leader of the Ladysmith Black Mambazo band, Joseph Shabalala, or however you say his name. I hate the fact that I can't say these names.
I know. And, you know, the sad part, his brother was killed. Fairly soon after this album was made, just coming home from a party shot by a disgruntled white security guard for being in a racially motivated deal. I just hate hearing that sort of stuff.
I'm surprised that he didn't let Linda sing a whole verse by herself. I don't see how that could happen, but
yeah.
Anyway. But it's a great song.
It's my second favorite song on the album. Yeah.
What's your favorite?
Graceland.
Everybody's favorite is Graceland, Tony.
Yeah.
All right. So we move to the third song on the second side, which is Homeless.
Homeless. Homeless. Moonlight stadium on a midnight lake. Homeless. Homeless. Moonlight stadium on a midnight lake. Homeless.
We are homeless.
The moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
And
homeless. The song is mostly in Zulu, right? I mean, a big chunk of it's in Zulu. According to the thing I read about it, Paul Simon had sent Joseph Shabalala, the line, "We're homeless, homeless, moonlight sleeping on the midnight lake," and then he just fleshed it out with all these Zulu lyrics to make up the bulk of the rest of the song.
Well, but he was very shy about doing it. And originally, you can actually, on the 25th anniversary edition of this CD, there's the original version that Paul Simon sent to him.
We homeless, we homeless, we homeless, we moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. We homeless, we homeless, we moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake.
And it's just Paul Simon and a guitar, but he'd flown him up to London, and I guess this is where they were recording in Abbey Road. And so they were working on it, and it just all of a sudden they were just trying to force it into this guitar thing. And but then, yeah, so it was very spontaneous, very spur of the moment, and then Paul Simon came in and started singing the homeless part.
All right. And he split credit with him on this song,
yeah,
which would cause some others to wonder why they weren't.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we move there. Along. All right, so we'll move on to the next song, "Crazy Love, Volume 2." I just have one question for the two of you. Is there a Crazy Love Volume 1?
I know about Simon. This love, 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 crazy love.
That's what I was thinking it was.
I just
Van Morrison.
I asked these questions to get Doug to sing.
Well, I mean, that's why we're shooting through the roof on these downloads here lately. I've opened up. I've quit hiding my light under a bushel. This is also the song that features Fat Charlie the Archangel.
Oh, man, the lyrics of this song are something else. That's a good song.
I love this. This is probably my third favorite song on the album. It's just, I love the guitar riff on it.
Yep. But let me just say something, because I haven't said it yet. My guitar lecture. Here's another one of these albums where the guitar player participates in the song and doesn't do a tap dance on top of it. And it is entirely appropriate. And every lick is unpredictable. You go, what? Where did that come from? What are you doing?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Ray Fairfield. Yeah, and unfortunately he died recently.
He died early.
Yeah. Rhythmically, and just the weird arpeggios he would be able to come up with.
So good. Right after this, we move to Louisiana.
Well, that was your mother, that was your father, before you was born, dude, when life was great. You are the burden of my generation. I sure do love you, but let's get that straight. Well, I'm standing on a corner.
Yeah, now this song... this song, compared to everything that came before, and you guys, I'm sure, are going to disagree with me, feels out of place, but it's one of the things that makes it so great, because it doesn't have that sameness to it, you know? He recorded this with a good rock and Dopsy and the Twisters. Mm-hmm. It's just this great Zydeco accordion song. It's fun as hell.
It is.
But it is one of the two songs on the album, the one following this, where the people who participated were a little miffed at Paul Simon for not giving them credit for helping to write the song.
I think that's the risk you take when you lay down the band's tracks before you write the song.
Well, supposedly, it sounds like a song called "My Baby, She's Gone."
This time she's gonna stay. My little woman, she's gone, 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 y'all. night she's gonna stay.
Which is registered to a guy named Alton Reuben Sr., who is also known as Good Rockin' Dopsy. So I think he might have a point. I've never listened to Baby She's Gone to know, but the way the band handled this, as opposed to Los Lobos that we'll talk about next, is they thought the exposure they got for this was good enough. I mean, they were miffed about it, but it wasn't like they were going to hold a grudge. They're like, look, we got some exposure from it. It's fine.
Yeah. Well, another question for you, Tony, is do you know what Paul Simon thinks holds all of these songs together? I mean, we just crossed the world and went from South Africa to New Orleans, and then we're about to go to L.A. But in his mind, there was one thing holding it all together.
Accordion? That's
the accordion, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I got you. I can see that.
And there's some really cool, the saxophone on this is, I really like the saxophone on this.
It's a great song for a party.
It is. It's fantastic. And
wondering what the city folks will do.
And he's saying that this girl's as pretty as a prayer book. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's the Anglican Book of Common Prayer he's referring to. I have no facts for that.
Yeah, we should ask him.
He said, what?
So we come to the final song on side two and the final song on this album, All Around the World or The Myth of Fingerprints.
He said, there's no doubt about it. It was a myth of fingerprints. I've seen them all, and man, they're all the same. Well, the sun gets weary and the sun goes down. Ever since the watermelon. And the lights come up.
And this is the one that Los Lobos is on, and the one in which they really got their nose bent out of shape for not getting co-writing credit on this song. Steve Berlin from the band said that they were playing around, and Paul evidently came in the studio and was like, hey, what's that? You know, I'm sure that's exactly what happened. Hey guys, what's that? He said, okay, well, yeah, I like that. We'll share the song or whatever. And then they didn't see their names on the writing credit anywhere on the album. Yeah. And they assumed it was a mistake. And then it just more time passed and it wasn't on there. And this is a quote from him. He says, it was not a pleasant deal for us. I mean, he quite literally, and in no way do I exaggerate when I say he stole that song from us.
Well, he even said they said, well, we're going to get our lawyers involved. And he said, go ahead, try to sue me.
Yes, see what happens.
See what happens. Yeah.
Paul Simon says that never happened, but I don't know.
I mean, I just can't imagine Los Lobos being
there. Here's the thing about Paul. Here's the thing about Paul Simon. I love his music, but there's a history of him not being the most gracious in terms of sharing credit on stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
When he made that big flop of a movie, immediately following that, he had lost Warner Brothers, I believe, $7 million. Immediately following that, he started getting the proceeds from the live recording of the Simon and Garfunkel reunion. And he wanted to give all of that to Warner Brothers to pay back for what he had lost. And that makes me wonder if he's just so proud of it as a songwriter. That's his real motivation rather than any financial interest.
There could be that. I mean, before I realized the actual true story about why he wiped Garfunkel's lyrics off of that album, you know, the legend is that he was just being a jerk, but it sounds like the truer story is that Garfunkel just lost interest. And so Paul Simon's like, well, I'm not going to throw this away. I'm going to salvage it.
Well, and he also, he was really clear about the fact that the album had become much too personal
for
him to do with someone else. And hey, the guys put out three fantastic albums before this. He'd really established himself as a, artist on his own.
Right.
The two did not go together anymore. And the songs on that album don't go with Garfunkel. And the other thing about the breakup is what started it at the very beginning was Art Garfunkel was in Catch 22. Originally, both of them were going to be in Catch 22, but they dropped Paul Simon's character. So Art Garfunkel is finishing up this album and it's postponing everything.
Right.
And
then,
Paul waits and waits and waits and Art Garfunkel comes out of that. And then he decides he's going to make another movie.
Yeah.
Carnal Knowledge. Yeah.
So
it's a good movie.
Is it?
Yeah. It's a really good movie. Well, Paul Simon got to be in
One Trick Pony.
Annie Hall. He was in
Annie Hall. He was in Annie Hall. That's right.
Which makes him even more New Yorker than he was. That's the most New York movie ever made.
So before we go on to the recommendation, I think this is a really great quote from Paul Simon that I just want to read because I think it sums up kind of this album and his take on it. And he says this is his opinion. So I'm not saying that he says this is fact, but he says his opinion. He says in an interview I read, it says everybody had something they wanted to accomplish that was on some level beyond what the actual struggle was. The ANC wanted to establish the fact that nobody does anything without their permission. The musicians wanted to get their music out to the world. And I wanted to record music that I loved. Hmm. And I think if you understand that and all the junk that was thrown on him kind of comes into context, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So that was Graceland by Paul Simon, 1986 album, big album. And as you could tell, we all have our opinions about it. Some good, some not so good, but,
Well, I think we can compare what a gentleman Tony is when he disagrees with an album compared to some of the other people on this show.
But anyway, so because I took on the lead role of kind of guiding the conversation, we're going to go to Doug for a recommendation this week.
Oh, Tony, you caught me off guard. Well, now that I think about it, I do have something. It's a biography about Paul Simon that I really enjoyed. I'm going to say right from the beginning, this is not one of those biographies that beats up the person that they're writing about. I'm pretty sure he
had a hand in it.
Pull some punches on some, but it's a very good, it's called Paul Simon, The Life by Robert Hilburn. And if you consider Paul Simon's life, that's a 60-year career, and it's not like he was petering out at the end. I mean, he's not dead yet, but he has slowed down. His last album was good. I'm surprised JM didn't bring up the fact he made an album with Brian Eno. Yeah, the color of Mighty Mind, okay. I'm tired. Anybody care what I say? No. Painting my hair the color of mud. Tell me who's gonna love you when you look so gone. He has a remarkable career that spans all of almost all of rock and roll, and it's interesting to hear about it and to hear what we really didn't talk about his place as an American songwriter. But if you take Dylan out, I don't think anybody else can say I'm a better songwriter than Paul Simon.
He's
pretty much at
that.
The top.
I agree with that. Yeah, his lyrics are just incredible.
Yeah, and he's a little bit more. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why he gets a little bit short shrift in the rock and roll world is because his songwriting is pretty sophisticated. There's arrangements. He's always got just really slick musicians behind him. He chord changes are always interesting. You know, that was one of the things he said about Graceland was that it was almost too easy, that some of the stuff was just so simple that when he was trying to bring all these New York guys to play with them, they were just like, this is almost too easy to play behind. Yeah,
well, he's a gifted person who's made a huge contribution to music in this country, and it seems like he's always been kind of on the sideline, but he keeps pumping out the great music.
Yep. Well, that's it for tonight's show. Next week, we're going to be taking a look at another stunning album by another quintessential British band, The Kinks, are the Village Green Preservation Society.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save the old duck, Bonneville and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save
Georgia. Look us up on Facebook, and now we're on Instagram at Tony.
Tapping.vinyl.
Tapping.vinyl. And we're on Twitter at TappingVinyl. Also, you can email us at TappingVinyl@gmail.com. Please leave us a note or a review, or let us know what albums you would like for us to take a look at in an upcoming podcast. And if you know of anyone that likes music or the LP format or both, be sure and let them know about this podcast. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe. This is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11. And good night, poor boys and pilgrims.
Yeah, well, there's only one American, I think, that could pull that off.
Michael Jackson.
Roy Head.
Huh?
Roy Head.
I don't know.
You ever watch Roy Head move when he's singing?
I don't even know who the hell Roy Head is. So.
Okay, you can cut that out then.
That sounds like something for the after the close.
After the outtake.
I don't know who Roy Head is.